So half the material on the final exam will be material, covering material since the last exam, and the other half will be from previous material. That turns out to weight all the sections of the semester evenly. So it would be reasonable to spend more time studying the recent stuff than the older stuff, but the older stuff is not negligible, obviously. Are there any things that you can think of that need clearing up from, yeah?
So about the fire and Villiger reaction where you insert the O,
yeah,
how that's analogous to air oxidation of benzaldehyde.
Yeah.
It seemed like there was two reaction mechanisms, one where there's an H minus migration, and one where you like take off an H and the E2-like reaction.
Yeah. Why don't we draw it on the board, the two mechanisms? So the Beyer-Villiger reaction. Somebody else? What is it that reacts in a Beyer-Villiger reaction? Do you remember, Brian? A peroxycarboxylic acid and a carbonyl, but not a carboxylic acid. It's a ketone. Okay. So we're going to react this with a peroxycarboxylic acid. And one that's commonly used is metachloro, or that was at least very popular. I'm not sure that it's the most popular now. Is this one. And the only reason you use metachloro per benzoic acid is because it crystallizes well, so it's easy to work with to purify. Okay, so what happens? Somebody with a mechanism for us, Sudarshan?
The OH.
Pardon me?
The O of the OH attacks the carbonyl.
Yeah. Now, if we had base catalysis. Suppose it was base catalysis. This is good stuff to review. Suppose it's base catalysis. What would happen first? The base would take the proton off the acid. It's a peroxy acid, but still it's quite acidic. Okay, so you'd get the anion of the peroxy carboxylic acid, and then what would it do? So this will attack the carbonyl. Okay, what about if it were acid-catalyzed, what would happen? Notice that the peroxycarboxylic acid itself is an acid. Not as strong as a normal carboxylic acid, but it's acidic. So you probably wouldn't, if you just mixed the two, it would probably be acid-catalyzed. What would happen first then, Sudarshan?
Then it would be carbonyl.
So it would protonate the oxygen of the carbonyl, C plus for the carbonyl carbon, and now it would attack a protonated acid, a different molecule, and that would lose a proton. And either way, you get the same product, although in one case you'd get first the anion O minus from the former carbonyl carbon and O, and I'll just write AR for the aryl group rather than writing it all out. And in the case of more acid catalyzed, this would be have a proton on it. Okay, now what next? What kind of thing have we often seen when we have a peroxide? Derek? Right, break the OO single bond. So sigma star OO is the big deal. Why is it particularly good to break it in this case? Yeah. Yeah, lone pair repulsion makes the bond weak. But so what's going to happen is something anionic is going to attack this oxygen, and this other oxygen of the peroxide is going to be a leaving group. What I intended to ask is, why is that such a good leaving group? Because it's a carboxylic acid anion, right? So this is going to go out and give a carboxylic acid anion. And the only question is, where is the high HOMO that's going to attack the oxygen? What's the most obvious one in this case? the most obvious high HOMO. Yeah? Negative charge on the O. So you could imagine, I would twist this down so it attacks backside, right? Because we know SN2 attacks the backside of the atom. So I'd twist this down here, and then I'd have this come in, the negative charge from the oxygen at the top, attack there, and carboxylate would leave. How does that look to you, Young? So this negative charge here of the oxygen, so you're forming a bond between these two oxygens and this anion leaves. It's like SN2. But what's not so great about that, Young? You're forming a new OO bond, which is not a weak, which is not a strong bond. What else is bad about it? Yeah, it's a three-membered ring. So that's not so great. So what happens instead? We'll remove that arrow. What other electrons might move to displace the carboxylate? It's not the first thing that would probably spring to your mind, Matt. The R group with its electrons. So it's an R minus, an alkyde shift. Or had this been an aldehyde, it would be a hydrogen there, and it would be a hydride shift. Right? So these are the electrons that come and do that. Now, that's not the first thing you'd normally think about the sigma bond of a sigma carbon-carbon or carbon-hydrogen bond being a high HOMO to attack. But what makes this better than it might otherwise be? Can anybody see? Brian? Right. We've got this, the charge on the oxygen, which can come in and reform the very strong carbon-oxygen double bond when those electrons take off. Yeah?
Is the reactivity determined at all by the R group, like how long it'd be or anything?
Well, by which, this R group?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and people study that as to what the migration tendency is of different groups. You might think that things that are the most electronegative, right? Since what's shifting is R minus. So you might think that the most electronegative things on R would make it shift best, because it'd be best R minus. In fact, that's not true. It's the least electronegative things that tend to shift. Can anybody see why that would make sense? Why you'd want R here, even though formally it's R minus that's doing the shifting, so you might think the better R minus, the better. In fact, the more electron withdrawing things you have on R, the less inclined it is to shift when you look at a lot of different things. Derek? Can't hear very well.
Is it because that there's less electron density between the R and the O?
Right. If this is something electron withdrawing, you don't have much electron. You have less electron density here, and that's the very thing you need to do this displacement, is electrons available here. So if the R is something that's stabilizing these electrons, it's not going to help it attack. So yes, there is, people have studied that kind of thing. And H moves the best. H plus is a relatively common cation. So it's not very electronegative, but it's the best at moving as H minus or H minus. Okay, so that's the Beyer-Villiger. And what's the product of a Beyer-Villiger oxidation? Yeah? Yeah, it inserts an O in the ketone bond, so the ketone becomes an ester. So the product is R-O-O, R, and a carboxylic acid, of course. Yeah?
So if you started with an aldehyde instead of a ketone, would you have a R minus shift, or would you take it off?
Let's think about an example like that. Suppose we have... Suppose this were an aldehyde instead of a ketone. That's the idea. So suppose it's R. I'll make it AR, an aryl instead of an alkyl, just for familiarity. But the same thing is true. So AR double bond O, H, and react that with a peroxy carboxylic acid, HOO, C double bond O, and I'll make this AR. And then, we were just saying that the proton is that is hydride is the best shifter, right? For the very reason that hydride is not such a great anion. It doesn't hold the electrons tightly, so that the proton's electrons from the CH bond, former carbonyl, are readily shift. So that this shifts over in the same kind of mechanism, and we get AR, double bond O, OH is shifted now, plus the other HO, C double bond O, AR. Okay, so you can see it's exactly the same mechanism. Right? It's just that we're starting with an aldehyde rather than a ketone. Why did I choose to make it AR? I said I did it for familiarity. Have you ever seen that reaction? That's the one that's the benzoic, the autooxidation, as it's called, of benzaldehyde to give benzoic acid. Remember the bottle with the benzoic acid solid inside it that we looked already at last semester? It's exactly the same reaction. And weren't those the two that you asked to compare?
Yeah. I just said when you drew the mechanism for air oxidation of benzaldehyde, you had it taking off the hydrogen.
Yeah, okay. There are two. This is the second reaction. First, you make aldehyde into the peroxy acid, and then the peroxy acid reacts with the remaining aldehyde. So what we're showing here is the second step, why you don't get peroxy acid as a product from that, why you get benzoic acid, because the peroxy acid, which indeed you make as an intermediate, gets reduced. And it oxidizes the benzaldehyde to give a second. And so, but the question, your question is, where do you get that? Where do you get this? And that's a free radical reaction. So AR, O, H reacts with X dot. And this is a free radical chain reaction. So tell me what kind of arrows to draw and where to draw them. Somebody... Nancy? Single-headed arrows. Where should it go? Right, it's going to bond to the H, so we'll have it end here. And now we'll need another single-headed arrow to make the bond, which comes from the CH bond. Right? And the other electron in that CH bond goes to the carbon. So we get AR C double bond O free radical. Right? It's an acyl radical. Remember where we saw the cation equivalent of this? An acylium cation? Yeah, Melvin Newman, right? Newman's method of getting around steric hindrance and Fischer esterification was to make an acylium ion. Or what other really common reaction involves acylium ions? Pardon me? Can't hear.
Never mind.
Friedel-Crafts acylation. Right, you start with an acyl halide, aluminum chloride or something like that, takes off the chloride, makes an acylium ion. So this is an acyl radical instead of an acyl cation. And can you guess what it reacts with? Yeah.
Oxygen.
Right, O2. This is where the air comes in. So O2... So we get AR, C double bond O, O, O radical. And what happens to that? Kevin, you got an idea? What's that radical do?
It takes the...
Right, so this is X. Right, so it pulls the H off and becomes the peroxy acid. So you have this free radical chain reaction going on with air, with oxygen in the air. But the product you made gets reduced by the starting material to give two molecules of benzoic acid. Okay, does that do it now? Or was there something else that you were worried about?
I was actually talking about after you reacted the peroxy acid with the aldehyde.
Yeah.
You have that intermediate where they're both combined, just like in the ketone part.
Yeah.
But one of the R groups is an H.
Yeah.
So, and in the mechanism that you drew like a week ago, you have a base taking off that H and forming a double bond to the O, the other O. Like, as opposed to a hydride shift, removing it from the base and leaving the electron behind. I just wasn't sure where it was.
Do you have the picture that I drew? Because I'm now skeptical today. Oh, good for you. Yeah, I drew the wrong thing. Let me just a second. Let me just look at a second. What I drew is wrong. Thanks for picking that up. So I'll erase here to make. Well, I'll draw it over here. What I drew in the heat of the moment is the equivalent of this. I've had a base take this hydrogen, take this proton, and then had this leaving electrons here, which then make a double bond and this thing leaves. Okay? That actually isn't what happens. I was right in drawing a base taking a proton, but what was I wrong about? Can anybody see? Max?
Which proton?
I should have drawn it here. Right? Which then makes this anion, which is what helps this one move. Actually, now that I think of it, I'm just trying to think how you prove this. Because it could happen in principle either way. The nice thing about doing it the way that I just said was correct is that this proton is much more acidic than this one. So it's easier to pull this one off and quicker than it would be to pull this one off. So it's plausible that it goes this way. But it might not be absolutely excluded that it goes this way, because you might get some, as you're trying to pull this proton off, these electrons are being stabilized by mixing with the sigma star and this thing leaving. So it may not be cut and dried as to which way it goes, although I suspect it's the way that you thought it should go, not the way that I drew it. Okay, I can think of a way of telling whether this particular hydrogen is being removed at the time that this we're getting to the transition state for this reaction. Right, if you made that a deuterium, then this reaction should be slowed down if you can measure the rate of it. Okay? So there is a way of going about that. And I'm not quite sure what I've been. I sort of suspect the experiment might have been done, but I don't know. Kevin?
Can you talk about the kinetic isotope effect?
Yeah. What's the quantum mechanical basis for the kinetic isotope effect? Darren?
Is it like a greater as opposed to the weight function?
Right. So the greater mass concentrates the wave function and makes it lower in the barrier. So a greater mass has a lower kinetic energy than the higher mass. That's true for any atom. But the difference is much more dramatic for hydrogen than it is for anything else, because the change in mass is so very big between 1 and 2, the fractional change in mass. Nothing else has that big a change. Okay, so then but what's important is that if you're comparing that starting point where deuterium is more stable than hydrogen, and you want to see how much energy do you have to put in to get to the transition state for a reaction, the question is, what's the nature of that bonding to hydrogen at the transition state that determines the rate? Because if the hydrogen is still bonded at that transition state, right, then it will show the same difference between hydrogen and deuterium as the starting material did. So the amount of energy necessary to get from the starting material to the transition state will be just the same. Right? However, if the bond has become weaker in the transition state, then the deuterium is not as far below the hydrogen, and now it'll be harder for hydrogen than it is for deuterium. So that's the basis of the kinetic isotope effect. What would happen if the bond got stronger in the transition state? There are examples of this kind of thing. What would happen if a bond got stronger in the transition state? How about the relative rates of the heavy and light isotope effects? The heavy and light isotopes. Okay, Caitlin?
Then deuterium,
it's an inverse isotope effect. Okay? But kinetic isotope effects are really neat because it's a direct evidence of the importance of quantum mechanics. Right? There's no way that you could explain that in terms of bonds and things before quantum mechanics. On the other hand, people didn't have the isotopes available before quantum mechanics, so it wasn't possible to do the experiment, so nobody was bothered by it. Derek?
The reaction we have up there, how do we know that when the base attacks the hydrogen on the OH, that it's a two-step process instead of just like an elimination there?
In principle, it could be a two. I doubt that it is, but it could be. It might be. If so, then you'd expect a deuterium isotope effect here if you're breaking that bond in the transition state. On the other hand, if the hydrogen has already been transferred, then there would be no isotope effect because it started out bonded here, it ends up bonded here. In either case, it's bonded. So the bonds would be a little bit different strength probably, so there would be a tiny isotope effect, but not the big kind. Okay, but that doesn't inhibit the validity of the experiment we talked, because this proton and this proton are different. This one starts in the aldehyde position and doesn't exchange with anything else. This one is the OH, so you could test either one if you wanted to for the effect of deuterium on the rate.
Well, if it was an elimination reaction with the hydride shift occurring simultaneously, then if we had a deuterium shift,
It's not trivially obvious what the nature of the bond, how tightly this hydrogen is being bonded when it's shifting from here to here. The bond may be getting weaker. One could imagine it's getting stronger. And in fact, it's a little bit subtle because we're talking about stretching a bond. But obviously the bonds are also bending and vibrating, so those have isotope effects on them too. So you have to do a very careful calculation to predict theoretically what a real isotope effect is, because the mass participates in several normal modes. You remember what a normal mode is? That's something. It's some pattern of vibration for the molecule as a whole, where all the atoms move at the same frequency, some more than others.
So what do you say the normal mode of like C double 1C bonding comes at?
Pardon me?
When we talk about a normal mode in terms of IR, do we mean we're just looking at when looking at specific bonds?
No, that's what makes IR complicated, is rarely is a bond, is a band in the IR, a particular peak, just the motion of one bond. Usually it's a lot of bonds. Under what circumstances does it tend to be just one bond and then relatively easy to analyze? Brian? Yeah, when that frequency is different from all the other nearby frequencies, then they don't couple with one another and you see the vibration of a single bond. For example? Right, C double bond O is a double bond, very high frequency, but not as high as CH. So it doesn't couple with CHs, it doesn't couple with CCs, bending and so on. So carbonyl tends to stand out. What else makes carbonyl a particularly good thing to look at in the IR, besides the fact that it tends to stand alone in frequency? Caitlin?
The atoms are very different, so it's got a good handle for
structure. Very different what?
C and are very different.
Very different in what? In weight?
In polarity?
Yeah.
So you kind of have a handle for structure.
Right, so you have a good handle to interact with light, a big change of charge when it vibrates. We could just, not that this is a particularly good example, but it is something I had thought that I might put into the last lecture. But there was plenty of other stuff there. I thought it might be fun to review, to look at the NMR and IR spectra of cortisone. To see, now, of course, this is a complicated molecule, and we're not going to understand every peak in the spectrum. But I thought it might be fun to look at this and see if any of the peaks in there are ones that you can that you can say what you think they're due to. So this is the proton magnetic NMR spectrum of cortisone, right? And it's measured in dimethyl sulfoxide D6 solvent. Why do they use D6 dimethyl sulfoxide, regular old dimethyl sulfoxide? Remember what dimethyl sulfoxide is? Pardon me?
I
punched a button here by mistake somehow. Okay, so it's DMSO D6. Why do they use D6? It's more expensive. Yeah, Matt.
Because otherwise you get peaks from ages.
Otherwise you're going to have an enormous peak due to the solvent, right, that's going to wipe out other things. So this wave makes the solvent invisible to the extent that it's completely deuterated. But it's never going to be 100% deuterated, so there's probably going to be a little peak in there someplace that's the solvent peak. Okay. Can anybody see any peak in here that they think they might know? Brian?
Maybe the methylene group by the hydroxide.
This one?
No, up.
Yeah, this one?
Yeah. That might have been the 6.5, except it doesn't seem like the splitting's right.
It's 5.5. The scale goes left to right. Okay, but you expect this one at least to be pretty far downfield, and what multiplicity do you expect for it? It should, the size should be 2. But the multiplicity is how many things is it split into? Should it be one peak, two peaks, three? Christine, what do you think? Tell us some of the factors you're thinking about. Think out loud. Yeah. And why it does have a H on an adjacent atom here. Here's carbon, OH.
Right, but that one's what exists through carbon.
But probably it's exchanging, almost certainly. Maybe, but maybe not. So there might be a small splitting from that one. maybe it's sort of, remember what happens to peaks if you have two peaks and then if it doesn't exchange, you get two sharp peaks. If it exchanges rapidly, then you see a single peak. What if it's in between? How does the pattern change? Do you remember? It begins to broaden, then the two peaks come together, and then they sharpen up. Right? So it might be in the situation where it's beginning to broaden or something. We don't know for sure what it would be. Okay, but anyhow, it should be pretty far down field because of having a carbonyl next to it and also the oxygen withdrawing away. Are these two hydrogens equivalent? Could they split each other in principle? Caitlin?
They do split each other, but we don't see them.
Okay, they interact with each other, but normally when you have a CH2, if they have the same chemical shift, you don't observe the splitting because there's no the light, it turns out, although we didn't go into this really, has no handle on it if they have the same chemical shift. And that was the thing, remember, where you start with peaks like this, and as they get closer together, the inner ones get bigger and the outer ones shrink until finally you have just a single peak. Okay, so that's true. But should those two hydrogens have the same chemical shift in principle? They might accidentally have the same chemical shift just by accident. But should they? Are they required to have the same chemical shift? Mostafa, what do you think? Pardon me?
I think they do. It depends on other chiral centers.
Are there other chiral centers in the molecule?
Looks like it.
Yeah, sure. There are lots of chiral centers. That's one, that's one, that's one, that's one, that's one, that's one. Right? So in principle, those two hydrogens are related how? Are they enantiotopic? Are their environments mirror images? Dre? They're diastereotopic. So in principle, they could split one another. But whether they're going to split one another is, we don't really know for sure. So it could be these two peaks here could be those two hydrogens, for example, with just a little bit of splitting of each other. See that? Because they're diastereotopic. That's a possibility. In fact, I bet that's true. Now we can peek, because the people who put this up, the Japanese group that puts up all these spectra, also puts up a tentative assignment. So these are at 4.1 and 4.4 roughly parts per million. So what do they say for 4.1 and 4.4? They say D and E. Right? So they agree with us. Okay? So we know what these two are. At least we agree with the professionals who assigned it that it's these two. There's some other peaks that are pretty far downfield here. Any ideas about those? This is obviously a harder spectrum than I would expect you to be able to assign completely. On the other hand, being able to pick out some things that you are able to identify is not a bad exercise. Victor? This is carbon number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Remember, C11 was a tough one to get the oxygen into. 12, 13, 14. So let me just go around, and you stop me if we get to some hydrogens that you think might be distinctive. Okay?
Yeah.
Here? Okay, those are adjacent to carbonyl. Also here. Also here. Also here. So probably, but this one, remember, is especially far downfield because of the oxygen. So these others are probably in this range in here. Right? It's going to be a little complicated to pick them out. Okay.
Yeah.
Aha! There's a vinyl hydrogen. That's like so. That these are each one hydrogen, right, in their area. The one of these and the other, right? So that looks like one hydrogen too, also. So probably this one. Shall we see? That's at 4.7. 4.7 is C. Whoops, they say that's B. Where do they say C is? Pardon me? Oh, they say it's the alcohol up on the top, yeah. Which is, remember, that's unpredictable where the OH is going to be because it depends. Why? Why does the OH have lots of different chemical shifts in different samples? Sharif?
Hydrogen bonding?
Because the amount of hydrogen bonding changes. It's dependent on temperature, concentration, solvent, and so on. So probably they're right. And here's another OH, right? So they say those are... Oh, no, they say this is an OH, and they say this is an OH, but they say this one is the vinyl. I don't know whether they're right about that or not. Probably they're right. So anyhow, that's we've done what's cherry picked the easy things here. So here's the C13 spectrum of the same thing. So are there any peaks here or if not specific peaks, which ones might be relevant? Max? Yeah, all the carbonyls here, here, here should be way down. Probably these, that's probably one peak, just the digitization of it. Now, notice that all these peaks, this one, this one, this one, this one, are the same height. And we were talking in protons about the size of the peaks and whether it's one proton. Is that equally reliable in C13 and in proton spectroscopy?
No, the integration
will. Yeah, the integration is not so reliable normally in C13 spectroscopy. But still, whoops, I poked the button. Still, these are more likely than not 1:1:1:1. So four of them. 1, 2, 3. So where's the fourth one, probably? The one that's up here. So probably CC double bonds are also down. So probably this one, maybe that's nearer the acyl group, might be further down. And this one there. So let's just check that. So 1:22 and 1:50, roughly.
So,
well, 1:70, pardon me, yeah. Okay, 1:22 they say is 5. And 1:70 they say is 4. That's interesting, isn't it? It's reversed from what I hypothesized, and probably they're right because they've been doing a lot of these. But it must be that something about the conjugation of this makes the 4 carbon more affected by the carbonyl than the 5 carbon is, if this is right.
Yes, I was actually going to ask, when you look at proton NMR,
yeah,
do you look at the beta hydrogen to the carbonyl as well as the alpha hydrogen? Is that affected by any type of...
The beta one is not in an unconjugated system. The beta one is not special. Okay, are there any others that are good to pick up here? So this is the two CC double bonds. Those are the CO double bonds. What else is likely to be pretty far downfield? Probably this one, right? Is that what you meant? This one, and probably the next one would be this one. Right, so that's 80, close to 90 would be, we think, maybe this one. Close to 90, they say, is 6. Yeah. Oh, no, they say 6 and 7. 6 and 7. So they've got those backwards from what I might have thought. Everybody see that? There's another thing in C13 spectra that we didn't talk about, which is how crowded the groups are. Can make a difference in chemical shift. That might be a factor that went on here. Okay, anyhow, we've thought a little bit about NMR anyhow, yeah.
Are there any peaks like that are assigned to the solvent?
Let's see. I wonder, there should... what is the solvent in this one? This is DMSOD6 again. So we should have those methyls. So I wouldn't... Let's see, it should, you'd think there'd be some sort of a... Do 17 and 18 appear? Yeah, 17 and 18 appear here. I don't know. And 13. So yeah, I'm not sure, but this is easily done. I mean, obviously, people who are into this do things in DMSO and know exactly where that peak comes and know what to look for. I just don't happen to have that in my lore. Okay, but we could also look at the IR spectrum. This particular one was done in a KBR disk. How did you do your IRs in lab?
Sodium chloride.
In sodium chloride? You ground them up and pressed them?
No.
Pardon me? Oh, you just put a little thin film on top of a sodium chloride plate. Another way is to take a mortar and pestle, put a drop of your stuff and a salt, KBR here, and grind them together. And then press it very hard in between two dyes, and you get, that's what this is, a KBR disc, it says up there. So anyhow, what peaks do we look at here? Are any of these informative? How about this peak here? Whoops. How about this one? Or how about that one? What do you call those? Those are the fingerprints, right? But where are the peaks we're looking at? Yeah, 3300 up here. What's that? That's the OH, right? In fact, it might be wet. Right, this KBR disk might be wet. There might be water in there as well. Okay, where else? Any place else? Well, what are these peaks?
The CH.
Yeah, CH stretching. But again, those are coupled with one another because they're near one another, right? Okay. Is there anything here that's diagnostic? Yeah.
Around 1700 for the carbonyl.
Okay, so these are carbonyls here, right? In fact, I think there's a peak here, and here, and here, and here. There might well be four peaks there. And one way we might check that is try it in a different medium. Like here, this one is in Nujol, so it's ground up with mineral oil and put in a... Notice that cortisone is a solid. So many of the things that you did in lab were probably liquid. So you have to grind them up to do this. Okay, and now you can see again that there are four peaks here. One, two, three, four. It's a little clearer in this different solvent. Notice, incidentally, that OH is weaker here. Probably there was a little water in that other one. Okay, so how do we get four peaks in this region? There are three carbonyls. Yeah. But notice if you couple things, you only get the same number of peaks you start with. What happened here? Oh, I see. Somehow it's picking up faint signals here. Got the wrong show. Oh, here, there. Good, there we go. Okay, if you start with two peaks and couple them, remember, molecular orbitals, you get two peaks. So you're not going to get four from three by coupling. Why aren't these coupled to one another? Why would you not expect them to be coupled? Because they're far apart from one another. It's pretty remote, the interaction. But there'd be a little bit of coupling, but not very much. Where is there coupling? Kevin? Can't hear very well. Right, the alpha-beta unsaturated ketone. This has a double bond frequency, which isn't so different, and those are close to one another. So you got the in-phase and out-of-phase combination of those two. So there are, in fact, four double bonds that are stretching. So one of these, probably one of these, is the one where they tend to cancel one another, and it's therefore very weak. And the other one is the one where the two stretch to reinforce one another in their interaction with light. Okay, I was just thinking, had we had extra time on Friday, I would have gone on to that just to tie in a little more review. Brian?
Completely unrelated to this.
Good.
What was some experimental evidence that SF1 had a cation?
Well, it's not called SN1. That SN1 has a cation intermediate is one type of evidence, which we didn't talk about, is that things that make cations more stable make the reaction go faster. Right? Another one is, can anybody think of another one? Let's think about what, okay, Max, me. Ah, exactly. That you can attack from either side if you have the planar cation intermediate. So racemization is expected in SN1. Although often it's not complete racemization because even though an ion has left and you have a cation intermediate, the ion hasn't gone away completely. It's still near one face of the cation. So it tends to block that or to reassociate, so that then you can get a little bit of inversion even if you think it should be SN1. Yeah. Yeah, that's part of what I was saying about things that make the thing more stable, make the reaction go faster. Right, good. Victor?
When they changed the nucleophile...
Can't hear.
When they changed the nucleophile, there wasn't much difference because that is the rate determining step.
Right. If the rate determining step is the dissociation, then the rate shouldn't be dependent on what the nucleophile, how good the nucleophile is, or what its concentration is. Are people comfortable with the Fischer proof of the glucose configuration? What? Yeah, I thought it might be fun. To see, have you looked at what Fischer actually said? It's often interesting to see what the original person said. So I've got that here someplace. Okay. So this is Fischer's paper from 1891 on the configuration of grape sugar and its isomers. Now, he published this and figured out which one was glucose before he did something else that's pretty darn handy. What was that? The Fischer projection, right? So this is following Van 't Hoff's notation, and it's very, very much easier to understand in terms of Fischer's notation. So what we'll do is talk about what he says here, but understand it not in terms of these plus minus things, which are very unfamiliar to us and cumbersome to boot, but use Fischer's projection, which he used in the next paper he talked about. So how do we draw Fischer's projection to show the configuration of all the... Remember, the general idea is you draw all the possibilities and strike out everything but what's true. Okay, so how do you go about, Renchi, how do you go about drawing all the possible configurations for an aldohexose?
You first go from bottom up.
Yeah.
And you first draw one bone on one side, so let's say from the right side.
Yeah.
And then you draw the second bone, half of them on the right. Half.
Right. Okay, so we'll do that. And how many are we going to have? There'll be eight from the D series and eight from the L series, but Fischer was well aware from the outset that you're not going to be able to distinguish between the D series and the L series with anything he had, right? So you could draw just one series, not all 16 of them, and deal with just that one. So we'll draw eight. And we'll draw the little circle at the top that means the aldehyde. And now these are the D series. And 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 of course, no one, they knew the names of some sugars already, some aldohexoses. They knew glucose, and they knew mannose. And as he worked on this, he got gulose and several of the others, but they didn't know which was which. Now, so this tells how you know which is which. Okay, so here's the table. Let's see. It is first necessary to treat glucuric acid. What does that mean? What did he do? What's, you remember what glucuric acid is? The glycaric acids? Yeah. Right, so the top and the bottom are both acids. What's the relevance of that? Yeah?
So that means that if you inverted it, you could see if two different products made the same acid.
That's one factor, but there's another factor too. But see what he says about it. The two optical antipodes are known. The enantiomers are known by him of that. Of that is, the substance is chiral when you make two acids. Okay, so what can he say here? Would this one be chiral if you made two acids? If you made acid here and acid there? No, because it has a mirror here. So this one is out already. This one would be, this one would be. Would this one be chiral if they were both acids? Does it have a mirror plane here? It looks symmetrical though, doesn't it? But its symmetry is the symmetry of a propeller, right? Not with a mirror. It's still handed. This one's handed. This one's a propeller again. This. How about this one? If I make a circle at the bottom, it's got a mirror. So that one's out on the basis of this. Okay. So you can take out those two on the basis of that. So 7 and 8 must therefore be excluded. Glucose and mannose differ from one another because of the different orientations of the asymmetric carbon here. Right. So if this were glucose, this would be mannose. This glucose, mannose. Glucose, mannose. Glucose, mannose. Because they are the same at all the others. And he knows that, as he says below, because I here collect the facts that agree in leading to this conclusion. And so if we go down, they give the same osazone, remember, which makes a reaction here and also here to destroy that chiral center. When you add HCN to arabinose, you get both of them, which adds that chiral center in either hand. Fructose is reduced to a mixture of the two corresponding diols, top and bottom. And they can be interconverted by heating with quinoline, which changes the configuration. It takes off the alpha hydrogen, puts it back on either way. So he's got all this evidence that means that if one is glucose, the other is mannose. But mannitol and mannaric acid are optically active. So this cannot be mannose. Because if you had the top and bottom the same, it would not be optically active. What does that mean with respect to glucose? But that one can't be glucose, because this one can't be mannose. And in the same way, if this one can't be mannose, this one can't be glucose.
Can you explain why?
What?
Are you just looking at the bottom two and saying...
No, but from what he says here... The activity of mannitol and mannaric acid. So if you start with mannose and make the top and the bottom equivalent, either both acids or both alcohols, primary alcohols, it's still optically active. So by the same reason that this couldn't be glucose, it can't be mannose either. Right? But mannose and glucose differ only here. So if this isn't mannose, that isn't glucose. And the same thing is true. If this isn't mannose, this isn't glucose. Okay, so now he's got to there. So there are only these possibilities. Let's see. Let's see, go a little bit further here. What am I doing here? Okay. And now let's see what he does next. To distinguish which of these formulae belong to glucose and which to D-gulose, it's necessary to... So gulose and gulose. Where did he get the name gulose? He permuted the letters and dropped one, because what you change is the ends. If you make the aldehyde into an alcohol and the alcohol into an aldehyde, you change the ends, right? So that's gulose and gulose. So I don't know. I see people have to leave and so on, and we don't have to go through all this. But it's fun to see what Fisher himself actually said. It's pretty straightforward. Okay, but maybe we shouldn't spend all the time on this. Oh, okay, fine. Okay. Let's see. The distinguishing factor of which is glucose is necessary to consider arabinose and xylose. So now he goes down to the fact that you can do this Kiliani-Fisher synthesis. Right, which takes a pentose to a hexose. So we have do the same thing with pentoses. And we know that the pentoses that are going to be relevant to make glucose can't be the one that's like that or like that, can't be the one that's like that or like that. So it's going to be either this kind or this kind that can possibly give glucose, right? So the pentose that would do that would be this, 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 or this, this, this. Okay? Now, those two, you can find out something about. One of those is called xylose, and the other, as he says, is called arabinose. Incidentally, you know, in biology, there, you know, ribonucleic acids, RNA, is a big deal, or deoxyribonucleic acids. Where does the name ribose come from? Yeah.
Isn't there an oxygen inside the ring?
Well, that's because it's a hemiketal. Hemiacetal, right, is formed a ring. But the name ribose, yeah.
Maybe it's one with all of them on one side, so it looks like ribose.
Well, another one that was known at the beginning was arabinose. And the reason it was called arabinose was it came from a substance called gum arabic, right, which came from Arabia, from the tree sap and so on. So arabinose was well known, but ribose wasn't known until Fisher started doing this. Where do you think the name ribose came from? Brian? From what? Why did he permuted the letters in arabinose? So it's ribose is an anagram. It's cute, huh? Okay, so anyhow, it has to be one of these is arabinose, and the other one is xylose. Can you think of an experiment that will tell you which one? You have two bottles, and you have two names, ribose and arabinose. Or you know that this one is ribose and this one is arabinose, but you don't know which structure to draw on it. What experiment could you do that would tell you which one has this structure and which one has that structure? Brian? Right, so make the two ends equivalent. O here, O here. Right, this one's optically active, and this one is not optically active. Okay? So this one is arabinose, I think. Isn't the arabinose the one that's optically active? Yeah. So this is arabinose, and this is xylose. Incidentally, the other ones, the one that differs from this one at this position is ribose, and the one that differs from this one at this position is lixose. Where did he get the name lixose? He was shameless, right? Okay, so arabinose gives glucose and mannose, right? So one of these must be glucose and the other must be mannose, right? Pardon me? How do I know what?
How do you know that glucose comes from arabinose?
Oh, because he did it. He did the Kiliani-Fisher synthesis. So he added cyanide to add another carbon to the aldehyde, changed the cyanide into an acid. So it gives a cyanohydrin when you add to the aldehyde, right? It's an aldehyde. You add cyanide, you get OH, H, right? And CN, right? Now, it could have added from either face, so the OH could be either on the right or the left. It could be either this or this, right? The aldehyde carbon here becomes this carbon and these, right? But it could be either right or left. You make that into an acid, right? Then you reduce it back to an aldehyde. So you've got these two compounds. That's the Kiliani-Fisher synthesis. What Kiliani did was to make the chain longer. What Fisher showed was how to make this into an aldehyde. So that's why it's the Kiliani-Fisher synthesis. Okay, so one of these is glucose and the other is mannose. Right?
So we can accept the other two?
What?
We can accept the other two?
Yeah, so it can't be these. Right? But now, how can you distinguish between these two? Pardon me? No, that's not the guess. The guess is to distinguish these eight from the other eight. Nancy?
It's like glucose and glucose will form the same product.
Right. Glucose can be changed into gulose by changing aldehyde with alcohol, right? Which means changing end to end. So if you change end to end with this one, you get this one, although the mirror image of this one. Does everybody see that? If I grab here and rotate 180 degrees to make this go down here. Remember, a Fisher projection, you can rotate like this, but if you use a mirror, you get the enantiomer. So if I rotate it like a propeller, this one will become O on the bottom. This will be on the left, right, left, left. Everybody got that? So this molecule is exactly the same as that one, just been rotated, right? But now if I change what's on which end, aldehyde and alcohol, right, I get the mirror image of that one. So this is gulose. Now, how do I know it wasn't this? What happens to that one, Nancy, if I change the ends? It'll be the same thing again. Because if I rotate that one, I get this. Everybody with me on that? And then if I change the ends, it's the same thing I started with. So now you know that this has got to be glucose. But that's not all you know. What else do you know at this stage? Yeah? This is mannose. And this is gulose. And this is idose, the silliest name of all. Just the idem mark, you know, same deal. He was running out of ideas for how to name these things. Okay, so anyhow, he made 50 sugars, right and left-handed, and showed what they all were. It was really a great intellectual accomplishment. You know, at first you look at this and you say, there must be no way to figure that out. There must be all those isomers, but how could you figure it out? But he did it. Okay. So you may have other things to do. I don't want to hold you here if you want to get going. But if anybody has another question, I'd entertain it. Okay.
I'm not sure.
I think people are ready to go. So why don't people leave? Don't feel that you have to stay, but I'll entertain your question here. Yeah.
What's like the spectral connection between higher
Let me come closer. I can't hear. What's the...
Like, the special connection between anti-aromatic things and disrotation and aromatic things and conrotation?
Yeah.
What's the...
You remember the idea with aromaticity is that you have conjugation all the way around a ring. And the question is, when you close that ring, did you get special favorability? Right? So aromatic is stable compared to what? Compared to have double bonds that aren't in a ring. Right? And you get that because when you touch the ends of two pi systems, so the p orbitals are perpendicular to the ring that you're making, right? Those last two orbitals come together. Right? So for the very lowest orbital, that will go down in energy because they're all plus on the top and you get a new bond. But for the next orbital, which had a node, there's going to be a node there as well. So that orbital will go up in energy. So when you close the ring, the first orbital goes down, the next one up, the next one down, the next one up, the next one down, the next one up. Right? So if you have an odd number of these touchings, an odd number of orbitals that you're interested in, then more will be going down than up, and that'll be specially favorable. Okay? The lowest one will go down, the next one will go up, the next one will go down, the next one up. If they're an odd number, they're more going down than up.
Oh.
Right? So that's going to be good. So that's aromatic stabilization. Right? On the other hand, if you could rig the system such that there was a twist in it, Möbius style, then the lowest one will go up in energy. Because plus will touch minus. If the chain of double bonds as you went around had somehow a twist in it. Right? And the way you can get that is by having a conjugated system here. And if you twist the two things that are going to be touching in opposite directions, disrotation, the two tops will touch or the two bottoms will touch. Okay? So that's just like bringing them together, so top touches top, bottom touches bottom. Okay? So that'll be like normal aromaticity if you have disrotation. But if you have conrotation as things come together, then top touches bottom. And that's like Huckel, or but like Möbius, pardon me. Right? So now, depending on how many electrons you have, you want to do one thing or the other. Because you want the transition state to be as stable as possible. So if you have an odd number of electron pairs, you want to have disrotation. So the lowest energy orbital goes down in energy when the ends touch. And if you have an even number of pairs, you want it to be the other way around.
So anti-aromatic, you want it to be conrotation?
if it would be anti-aromatic normally, that is 4n pi electrons, get out of it by doing con rotation, so top touches bottom, so it doesn't conform to the normal criterion for aromaticity. Yeah, yeah. With Dewar benzene, there can be enough strain. Dewar benzene allows you to tell how much. I mean, Professor Bartlett, my advisor and teacher, said nature is like a permissive parent. She forbids, but she does not enforce. Okay, so that anti-aromatic thing. So you know disrotation of Dewar benzene opening a four-membered ring is forbidden, but it can happen if you push hard enough, and you change two four-membered rings into a very happy six-membered ring in doing that. But for something like that, it's unusually slow, given how far downhill in energy it is. But you're absolutely right. And what's the other way of making something go the wrong way, other than just pushing really hard? Yeah, Victor? I can't hear speak. Shout. Yeah, use light to make the electrons go into the next orbital. So then they'll behave the opposite. But every other orbital behaves opposite. Favorable, unfavorable, favorable, unfavorable. So put an electron where it'll be favorable instead of unfavorable. Yeah?
Can you draw examples
of... Draw what?
Can you draw examples of
you have to... This noise is competing. Shout out.
Can you please draw examples of conrotation and disrotation?
Draw an example of conrotation and disrotation? Yeah. So... So if you have some going back into the board, some pi system, right, and here in front, you have these two p orbitals. They're going to be interacting to make a new bond, right? So you can put the top so it meets the top. So this rotates in that way, that rotates in that way. But one is rotating clockwise and the other counterclockwise. So this is called disrotation. And top touches top. Or bottom touches bottom. It's the same idea. Right? Whereas... if you want the top to touch the bottom, this one rotates in, this one rotates in. Right? This is con rotation, both clockwise. And top touches bottom. Is that what you wanted to see or no? No.
In this case, it looks like everything should be con rotation if you have all the positives on top.
Yeah. Wait a second. If you're looking at the very lowest orbital, it has positive here, positive on top here, positive, 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 positive. Right. That's going to be unfavorable. It's going to make an anti-bond when the top touches the bottom. But that seems the opposite of what you said. Do you see what I'm saying now? If you do con rotation, the top, you have a chain that has a lowest orbital with no nodes, a first orbital with one node, two nodes, three nodes, and so on. And if I do con rotation, the very first orbital, when I bring the ends together, top will touch top. It'll be a new bond. It'll go down. Probably if I do disrotation, top will touch top. It'll be favorable. It'll go down in energy. The first pair of electrons, the lowest energy electrons, will go down in energy. The next pair will go up in energy, and so on. But if they're an odd number, then this is going to be favorable because more are going to be going down than up, right? And this one then does if will will be the favored mode. If it's, you know, you might say, wait, if the first one goes up and the next one goes down, you're never going to be able to get more going down than up, right? Then you have to look at actually how big the orbitals are. That they're not all, when you bring the ends together, they're not all the same because some have bigger orbitals on the end than others. So it's more subtle for the ones that are that favor conrotation. The ones that favor disrotation are pretty obvious. You have more going down than up. Yeah.
Right, so for the conrotation, if you have an even number of pi systems and they're in the lowest, so it's all positive, all negative. Don't you still want to do disrotation?
That's the very lowest orbital. So the very lowest orbital, you don't want to do conrotation because those electrons will go up in energy because you're making a bad interaction here. Okay?
You're not looking at the...
If I'm looking at the very lowest orbital, it's plus, as I said here, all the way around on top. If I do conrotation, this lobe of this one will touch this lobe of this one and try to make a new bond. But it does, it's making a new antibond, not a new bond. Because plus is touching minus. Somehow I'm not communicating here, and I can't quite see why. Can you help me, Aviva?
So the diagram on the right, you wouldn't have those signs like that if you were going to do conrotation.
Yeah, if it's conrotation, if you do conrotation, it's not favored.
It would be favored. So you would want the minus on the top and the plus on the bottom.
Yeah, so the next orbital, which has a node back here, would have pluses here, minuses here. That would be happy as a clam, that particular pair of electrons, to do conrotation. But already there's another pair that's been bad, right? The one that had pluses all around was bad. So the second one is good, but the first one was already bad.
So why would you ever do conrotation?
That's what I was saying here, that you have to look, it's a more subtle thing to see why it would be favored. Because it has to do with how, remember we could we did those circles, the mnemonics, to see exactly what the levels of the orbitals were, remember? And then you can see that they, although some go down and some go up, they don't go down and up the same amount. So although this one is so obvious, this rotation, because you have more going down than up. Here, at best, you have the same number going down and up. It could be more going up than down if it's an odd number. So if it's an odd number of electron pairs, 4n plus 2, you clearly want this, not more going up than down. You want more going down than up. Now, if you have both the same number going up and down, then it turns out this one is favored, but you have to look much more closely to see what the actual energies of the orbitals and the size of the orbitals when they're overlapping is. But it doesn't particularly surprise you that it might be that way. But I didn't prove it, right? But the other one is really clear. Yeah.
Can you just explain why the Dur-benzene has to do this again?
Why the Dur-benzene what?
Like, why you said Dur-benzene.
How this relates to Dur-benzene?
Yeah.
So Dur-benzene looks like this, right? With a double bond here and a double bond here, and it's got a hydrogen that sticks here and a hydrogen that goes back into the board here. This is one bond here that goes down behind the picture. Is that clear? Now, obviously, in opening this, you can't do conrotation. You're going to break this bond. But you can't do conrotation, move this hydrogen down and this hydrogen to the both of them, say, counterclockwise. Because when this one goes counterclockwise, you're going to try to make a six-membered ring that looks like this. Right? If this hydrogen moves into the middle of the ring, when it becomes planar, it's going to look like that with our benzene. Right? These just have impossible angles. It couldn't possibly be that. Is that clear to everyone? That you can't break this bond with conrotation because you'll make a... This is going to be a trans double bond here, which is just impossible with that many carbons in the ring. So you can't possibly do this. So however it opens, it has to be disrotation. This one has to move out, and this one move out. So you get a hexagonal benzene. Okay. Now, what's important is that what you're doing is breaking... Oh, that should be just a double bond there. You're breaking this four-membered ring. So these two orbitals that are sigma, making a sigma bond now, will become part of the pi system here. Right? And so you're talking about four electrons here. Right? And I went into a little more detail in the lecture about you might have thought that it's six electrons involved because there's six carbons in the ring altogether. But the proper way to analyze it is to look at those four, and I also did it in the lecture in a proper way. But this is why it has to be disrotation. Yeah, Nancy? Yeah, if the connectivity is Huckel, so that all the orbitals touch, there's not a twist in it, then 4n plus 2 is favored. Why? Because 4n plus 2 electrons is an odd number of pairs, and the one goes down, then up, down, up, but the last one will go down, more down than up, it's favored.
So to determine if the compound is aromatic, you just need to count the number of electrons in the pi system, and then that will tell you if it's aromatic or not?
Yeah. Yeah, as long as you don't have a twist in it, right? But that it's very rare to have a twist, right?
I had a little question. When you're doing decarboxylation of boron acid,
yeah.
Why do you attack with the pi system?
It's what?
Why do you attack with the pi system instead of attacking with the
edge? Let's just draw it here and see. So if we have malonic acid, right? And what we say is going to happen is that these electrons will go here, these here. Did I need to draw an... Yeah, right, and these here. And we get an enol, or an enediol, more likely. Okay, now, what's the question?
Why are you attacking with pi instead of
pi? Why am I attacking, rather than attacking here?
Yeah.
The reason is that at the time this happens, let me think about it a second. The orbitals that are involved, where these electrons are moving in, has to be these two overlapping. Right, up and down. Okay. And the same way, the electrons here have to be moving into orbitals that are overlapping. I'm having trouble. I think the thing has to be folded to do it properly. Yeah, this is going to do it. So we have to twist this enough that this is above this oxygen. And now we can see which orbitals are involved. The ones of the carbon-carbon double bond, the ones of this sigma bond, and the ones of this sigma bond. Okay, so this overlaps here. These overlap each other, and these overlap each other. Right. So it's not indeed, it's not planar when it happens. So what the H is actually touching is the top of the oxygen, not where the unshared pair is in the plane. And the reason is because you need to form the new bonds at the same time you're breaking the old ones. So this has to be touching this. This has to be touching this. And this has to be touching this. So it doesn't happen if it's planar. So you use the pi, not the unshared pair. Okay? Good luck on Friday. Yeah, maybe I'll have office hours on Thursday afternoon as usual.